Welcome everyone to the Virtual Working Summit 2013. I'm Penny Pullen and I'm your host for the calls in this Virtual Working Summit. If you'd like to see a list of all the speakers and their topics, then please visit www.virtualworkingsummit.com. Today I'm delighted to be interviewing Kevin Hall of Global Integration, which you can find at www.global-integration.com. As the CEO, he leads remote teams operating on three continents, so he certainly knows about virtual working. In fact, Kevin's been running virtual team training since 1994, so that's nearly 20 years. That's over 300 companies around the world. I think, Kevin, you said you had over 100,000 participants who'd been through your training.
That's right.
Fantastic. As well as that, you've written a couple of books, and I know they're full of useful practical tips. They're called Making the Matrix Work and Speed Lead. I'm sure we'll hear more about those later. Although we haven't yet met face-to-face, Kevin, we both used to work for Mars Incorporated years ago, and several of my ex-colleagues suggested that I should interview you for this year's Virtual Working Summit. I read your book, Speed Lead, and really agreed that you'd be a great addition to this year's lineup because people love practical, helpful tips that really make things work. Your question for us today, virtual teamwork, too much team and not enough work? That's a fascinating view. Can you let me know a bit more?
Yeah, that's right. Well, many organizations today are using virtual teams and matrix structures to cut across the traditional vertical silos of function and geography. So now many more people are working on multiple teams. They've got colleagues and even bosses in different locations, cultures and time zones. So the cost and complexity of cooperation have increased. And many organizations have found that this has led to actually more poor quality meetings, conference calls and emails. And our virtual team survey with about 4,000 people found that now people are part of an average of five teams and they're spending on average a day a week in unnecessary cooperation.
That's 20% of people's time.
Wow. It is, or the other way of looking at it is 9 years of your life, and some weeks you feel as though you had the lot, don't you?
All in one go, yes, exactly.
So the real challenge is how do we become more connected as we need to be virtually, but at the same time, how do we stay effective? And how do we make our communication, our cooperation engaging and interesting? So I would challenge the assumption that teamwork is always the best way to get things done. I think we're obsessed with teamwork, and I'd like to challenge that and offer some simpler, faster ways of getting things done that work more effectively through virtual working. And I'd also like to identify some of the key leadership and collaboration challenges that we've seen in our training around the world.
Okay. Sounds really interesting. So, at the start, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to be so interested in the issues of leading teams in a complex and increasingly virtual world?
Well, I guess because it happened to me. In my early days in Mars, I worked in a national organization. Then I moved into manufacturing and I ran a manufacturing plant. And in manufacturing, everybody worked for me. It was my own building. I could walk around and shake the hands. And it was all very tangible. Then I moved into a succession of business planning and HR roles that become more and more international. So now I'm dependent on colleagues in different locations who maybe don't work for me and I never met and they're in another culture. And frankly, in one of my head office roles, their bosses were telling them to ignore me. So how do I get things done changed radically in those roles? And it was pretty clear that my management skills and the way I worked with colleagues had changed. And so I went and looked out for training. And at one point, I was responsible for learning and development for Europe. And when I looked for suppliers, there really wasn't anybody back in the early 90s. And so we started to think about it ourselves. And in 94, after complaining for about a year there were no suppliers, I decided to be one. So I started the business then and really went out and worked with some early organizations who were working very globally, people like Hewlett-Packard and Motorola at the time, and found a very willing market. And since then, as you said, it's grown a little bit. So we now have businesses in Asia and Americas and Europe really focusing on this kind of matrix virtual and global way of working. And, you know, it's fascinating. The whole cultural piece is interesting. The challenges of working through technology. So it's a very enjoyable field.
And one that I'm also, grown into having started off also in Mars as well. So
sure.
Fascinating. So your view on virtual teamwork and that team and work split?
Well, I think the first thing to say is virtual is kind of the new normal for management and professional people. I mean, most people are spending at least some time working with colleagues in different locations. But a lot of people seem to think that virtual teams is just ordinary teams, you know, plus a little bit on email. And actually, it's much more fundamental than that. And it starts really with looking at how do we work together? How do we cooperate? Mm-hmm. So in virtual teams, the cost and complexity of cooperation has increased radically. Now, there are many flavors of virtual teams. You might just have a remote team. It might be a global team where you're working across cultures. It might be an extended team where you're working with suppliers or customers. So there's many different flavors of team. And depending on your flavor of virtual team, you might be working across barriers of distance, cultures, time zones, working through technology, and even organizational complexity. So maybe you're matrixed, or maybe you're working with companies outside your organization. But in all of these, the cost of cooperation increases. So, for example, when I bring together my global team for a face-to-face meetings, and I do it a couple of times a year, it costs us $100,000. By the time you've flown people to a location, you've got hotels, you've taken them out of the market, it's very, very expensive. Mm. Now, I often ask people, how many meetings have you been to in the last 12 months where you would write a personal check for $100,000? And the answer is usually no more than five or six, right?
Oh, that many?
Not really. So there's a cost issue. There's also a diversity issue. Now, I'm working with very diverse groups of colleagues. I'm working with people in different time zones where I have a limited overlap when I can work with them. There are communication difficulties through email, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these things add complexity. I mean, time zones is a very simple one, but what's the right time for a global conference call? There isn't one, right? Somebody will always be up in the middle of the night. So all these things add complexity, add what I call transaction costs. Now, we also know that actually the quality of that cooperation is pretty poor. Our virtual team survey, people tell us 2 days a week in meetings, as I've said, half of it's unnecessary. They also tell us they get 60 emails a day, three quarters of that is unnecessary. Now, you can't imagine any other area of business where you would be able to sustain that poor quality. If I was back in my manufacturing days and I went to my boss and said, we're about to launch this new factory, don't worry, it's only 50% scrap. Or we're about to launch this new product. It'll be fine. 75% of the time it won't work, but otherwise it'll be okay. It would just be ridiculous.
You'd be laughed out of the building.
You really would. So basically cooperation and communication have become much more expensive, much more complex. Mm-hmm. So in economics, if something is more complex and more expensive, the demand goes down.
Yeah.
But in organizations, actually, when we become more matrixed and more virtual, the demand for cooperation goes up. You know, we work with companies who are running one team program. You know, we have one client who's got 250,000 employees and they're running a one team program. Mm. That's a big old team, right? And wow. What we've learned is that actually it's our obsession with the idea of teams that's part of the problem. In fact, it's one of the major causes of the problem. Mm. If I look at large organizations, the majority of them have got teamwork as a corporate value. Yeah. They hire people for their ability to work in teams. They develop them. You know, if someone came to you in your career and said, I'm not sure you're a team player, that would be a kiss of death in most organizations. Mm. But if you think about it, teamwork is just a technique. It's not a religion. It's not a value. It's a way of working. Mm. And if we assume that everything has to be done in teams, then that can very easily lead to too many people in meetings the whole time. Yeah. It can lead to a slowing down of decision making, additional cost and frustration. No one likes to be in those meetings where we're discussing stuff we don't need to know.
No. I think the key word there is everything, isn't it? Obviously, some things suit teamwork and need that, you know, $100,000 spent to bring your people together, and other things don't.
Absolutely. And of course, in virtual working, particularly if, like me, you're leading a global team, the barrier of when it's worth doing becomes much higher.
Yeah, of course.
Because my first team meetings were down the hall in an office in London. It was no big deal if it was a lousy meeting. Mm. You know, it was 30 minutes and no transaction cost. Now, if I'm spending $100,000 of my money for a meeting and it's poor, I'm pretty disappointed. As a Yorkshireman and naturally generous, I get disappointed by that.
Well, of course, I think you need to make sure you get the most out of these times when you bring people together.
So what we realized is teamwork is only one form of collaboration. And I think because we use this word teams to describe everything, it causes confusion. So teamwork is a very specific way of working. In real teamwork, you've got a small group of people, 4 to 6 people maybe, with complementary skills who come together to achieve a collaborative goal. Yeah. So things like multidisciplinary problem solving, that's teamwork.
Yep.
The other thing about teamwork is it requires synchronous working. It requires us all to be communicating at the same time, if not the same place. So that means face-to-face meetings, conference calls, etc. So if you're not working synchronously, it's not teamwork. Yeah. So I call this way of working, this densely connected real teamwork, spaghetti teams, because they're like a ball of spaghetti, really interconnected and tangled. And that, you know, my proposition is that that is a really useful thing, but not very often. If you think about the time you really spend in that way of working, it's pretty rare, particularly in virtual teams, because our synchronous time is very limited. Now, the simpler ways to get things done, an alternative is what we call a star group, which is a simple hub and spoke organization where people with similar skills are coordinated by a common boss. So if you think about the traditional sales team, where each salesperson has similar skills and looks after their own geography or accounts, but they all report to a sales leader, then that's actually a group. That's a classic group. Now, groups are fantastically easy to manage virtually because they thrive on one-to-one contact. It doesn't matter if you're in a different time zone. I just pick up the phone at a time convenient to both of us. We don't have to have lots of conference calls because the collective working is relatively rare. It tends to be about one-to-one. Another way of working is the community, things like a community of practice or the functional community, where people get together to work on issues of common identity, common learning, et cetera, but it's still not a team. And a fourth one is a network, and it's not a team. A network is the connection between individuals. So what we try and do with our clients is to get them to think through each of those four ways of working, teams, groups, communities, and networks, because each of them need to be set up and managed and supported through technology completely differently. And if we treat every one of them as a team, then what we tend to do is we overshare. Yeah, we get the HR team together and we say, okay, we're all a team, therefore everyone needs to know everything that's going on. And pretty soon we're all sitting through compensation and benefits reviews and training and development reviews, and days go by, and actually the relevance is very poor. So getting the right fundamental means of cooperation is step one for me in virtual teams, because otherwise all we do is make ourselves more effective at doing the wrong things.
Okay, fair enough. Should we move into some questions and ideas
that have
come in from participants?
Yeah.
So, you know, we've got people from all over the place. So the first one, Sophie in the UK, who works for a medium-sized multinational, small to medium, says, in our company, people working in different offices have a responsibility to their global project teams successfully running and completing their projects. They also have responsibilities, both real and perceived, to their local line manager, their colleagues sitting next to them, and the rest of the local office. While our teams work really effectively most of the time, often it is the local commitments that seem to take priority. It's much more difficult to say no to the person standing next to you with a demanding body language or in serious need of help and support than to the team member hundreds of miles away at the end of the telephone, or more often than not, at the end of an email. What tips do you have, Kevin, for Sophie to help them to find the right balance between these responsibilities, both for individuals and for the company as a whole?
Okay, well, there's a very long answer for that, so let me kind of try and give a reasonably short answer for that.
Okay.
This is what we call divided loyalties, and it's very common in virtual teams. And Sophie's right that the local very often gets the priority because of the relationship, and maybe because of the legacy and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
So she's absolutely right to point that out. It's very, very common. And the human aspects are always more local. You know, it's just easier to form a relationship with someone who sits next to you. So the first thing I'd say is that it's only really the individual that can manage this. So once we've got two bosses or two teams or two streams of activity, then actually the only person who really understands the full picture is you. Yeah, if you've got two bosses, they only have half the picture, and they have much less motivation than you to sort it out. So our approach is very much about giving the individuals the knowledge, the skills, the authority, the confidence to manage themselves in this situation. Yeah. So there's a couple of things you can do. First of all, I should say that if your goals are actively conflicting, so if you achieve one, you fail the other, then you can never be successful in that environment. So if you've got genuinely conflicting goals, then you need to escalate it to get that resolved.
Yeah.
But if, however, you've got goals that compete for your time and your attention, that's completely normal. That's always been the case, right? So if goals compete, we have to think about how do we want people to resolve those? And if we don't give the individuals the authority, the skills to manage things like competing goals, to manage trade-offs, and to, and to balance dilemmas, then they're going to have to escalate the whole time. And, and these are complex skills.
That's not effective, is it?
It's not effective, but it's very slow and it's very frustrating and disempowering. So in my new book, Making the Matrix Work, there's a whole section on how we manage these competing goals, trade-offs, and dilemmas. And, you know, dilemmas are daily, especially that's why we have a matrix, for example. You know, we set up a matrix because we want to be good at multiple competing things. So she might find that section useful. At a corporate level, how do we get more aligned? Well, you'll also find some tools there on how you do that. But in a matrix, if you think about it, by adopting a matrix, we're saying we can't get aligned, because if we could get aligned, we could make the decisions at the top and just cascade them down through a simple vertical hierarchy. So
that
a matrix
doesn't happen
says,
much now, though. From
it
what
doesn't,
I see,
no, it doesn't
too,
because
the world
it,
is too complicated.
The world's too complicated, and a matrix says, yeah, you're right. We need to prioritize the global and the local, and the product and the function. Good luck. Now, so you know, unless we build that capability in people to manage that dynamic for themselves, then we're going to get a lot of escalation and a lot of frustration.
Interesting what you're saying, Kevin. I've just finished writing a book on leadership, and it's really, you're echoing so much of what I'm saying about leadership starts with the self, and you're saying only individuals can manage this. Individuals can't just rely on other people to solve those dilemmas for them. They need to really grasp them and work through them and tackle them and take that leadership as self.
I think definitely, and you know that's one of the whole themes of that book, which is really take charge, you know, create your own clarity, you know, push back at others around you, but first of all, sort yourself out, because if you sit there waiting, you know, especially if you have two or three bosses, if you sit there waiting for them to solve your problems, you're going to be very disappointed for a long time.
Yes, and not get much done,
exactly.
Which is another of the themes of this talk I think. Fantastic. Okay, so now we've got Jean from France, who has a question for us. Again, the questions for this session are all quite long, so I'll launch into it. In virtual teamwork, access and sharing of information is a key element to feel that we belong to the team. And even if the information is out there for us to find, we need to be told or tell people because there's so much noise and lack of time. As a consequence, we're also spending a lot of time in meetings listening to news of remote interest to our function in the organization. We're sometimes hearing a dialogue that would be efficiently replaced by a one-to-one telephone call. But it is efficient for the organizers to sequentially hear the successive reports of the members, and we want to be there just in case and to be part of it. As a matter of fact, I can myself be the organizer or a member. So the question that Jean has is, how could we reduce the number of participants in meetings or teams without decreasing the involvement and belonging of all? Wow.
Okay, well, the first thing is I agree. I think we're oversharing information hugely in organizations. And you know, frankly, my top tip for that would be just things like activity reviews, status updates, just stop doing them. No one's interested in that stuff. If you must, then stick them on a blog so people can ignore them later would be my number one tip. In my introduction, I talked about our obsession with teamwork, and I think this does contribute to the problem. So I'd start by simplifying cooperation. So try using more star groups, because they operate mainly through one-to-one communication and they don't need meetings. Then I do something which is called the bus check, and it's used by some organizations to at meetings and in projects. From time to time, the leader should say, who needs to be on this bus for the next stage of the journey? I think it comes from the book Good to Great. And, you know, it's a really useful discipline to say, you were great for this part of the project. We don't need you for the next bit. And then, you know, the person who's released can celebrate and go home and get on with their daytime job. So do a bus check. One of the things that I find very useful when I work with leadership teams in particular is I'm often invited to observe meetings. And I sit there and I do myself a checklist with the agenda items down one side and the names along the top. And a lot of the time, I'm not an expert in the content of what they're discussing, but every time someone speaks, I just make a tick in the relevant box. And at the end of it, you create a graphical record of who actually contributed to each topic. And what you find is that most topics only have two, maybe three people who are interested. And then you can use that to drive a discussion on which of these topics are actually relevant and who to. You know, if there is something that's relevant to all of us, can we do that first and then can half of us go home?
Yes.
You know, so use that as a way of making it graphical. But Jean also asked the other part of that question, which is the really interesting one, which is, but if I don't do that, how do I stay connected and that feeling of belonging? And this is very common in our workshops. It's one of the objections to going to simpler ways of working. And actually, I think what people do is they confuse team spirit and team structure. And so what we do is we end up sitting through boring meetings in the belief that somehow, magically, we're networking or staying visible to the organization or belonging. When in fact, what we're doing is being bored.
And wasting time that we'll probably be making up later on that evening or
exactly,
the weekend
and complaining about our work-life balance. You know? So I often ask people, you know, when was the last time you went to a conference or event where you said, actually, the content of it was terrible, but it was worth being there because we did some fantastic stuff in the breaks and the evenings, and everybody laughs. And of course, what do we do in the breaks and the evenings? We network, we problem solve, we create new relationships. All of that stuff is fantastically valuable, particularly in a virtual team, because we don't get to do that very often. So I said, why don't we cancel the fabulous presentation where the finance guy shows you a massive spreadsheet and says, I know you can't read the numbers, but the pattern is fascinating. Why don't we replace that with networking? And getting to know people. And so I think what I'd do is I would get rid of the unnecessary cooperation. I wouldn't structure myself as a team. I'd simplify cooperation. I'd cut out unnecessary content sharing. And I'd invest back some of the time I saved on building a sense of community, belonging, and identity. So I'd separate those two in my mind, because if you try and do the two together, you either get very dull networking events or very boring meetings.
Exactly, and there are far too many boring meetings out there at the moment.
There are.
So. Right, thanks for that. So we have a short question from Stella from the UK saying, how do you work virtually with a group where there's only a virtual group rather than a formally organized group? So I think Stella comes from a small business, and there are lots of them where there's, you know, there's a very small business, but working with partners, suppliers, and colleagues in a very loose, informal alignment. Would more team help with the work?
Well, again, I'd point her back to start with the nature of the work. Because if the work doesn't require teamwork, then there's no point doing it. So I would say, what work needs doing? If it's simply a matter of we cooperate and we hand on work to each other, then you know, you can organize yourself as a star group for the structure, but that doesn't mean you don't need good relationships. So I think it would still, you know, we know that it's true, don't we, that if we get face-to-face with people, even the emails become better. So I would still involve, you know, try to find an opportunity to build relationships, to build networks, to get to know people. I'd try and build into my conversation something that wasn't just work-related. You know, I'd try and build a loose community. But teamwork, to me, if it's just a loosely connected virtual group, then be happy, because that's going to be much more easy to organize, and focus on the quality of your one-to-one relationships.
I've got a comment from Peter from the UK, who works in local government. I think I might have got him on a bad day. He certainly agrees with your experience about the reality of too much team and not enough work on a regular basis. He thinks it's about the people involved. You know, partnership, joint working, co-location has great benefits, but only if people involved are flexible and prepared to adapt their own methodology for mutual benefit. What's the problem or the issue? Is it a shared one? What are you doing to address it? Can we address it better together? We need to get on with it. Some things work, others don't. We need to reflect and adapt. You know, too often teams are established because somewhere there's a strategy document that mentions partnership, and then you take lots of time to discuss, plan, and design a structure to suit the title. Within local government and public service, there are large numbers of highly paid people who spend most days in meetings with similar people from other departments or agencies, planning, mapping, looking in great depth at an issue or another, which is already sufficiently understood to require action. Unfortunately, these blockers have a level of influence that holds many frontline staff back from actually progressing action. And within that arena, some of us, Peter says, try and get on with things together with a small number of real partners. And this is where the best examples of teamwork coming from, which are then used by the blockers, as Peter calls them, to claim progress and start another round of discussion purported to be improving the process of delivery. Poor Peter. What comments do you have?
Well, yeah, he was having a bad day. what's interesting about that is you feel the frustration, don't you? And you
very
know, what
so.
We were talking about earlier, unnecessary meetings, delays in decisions, you know, frustrations of stuff we just don't need to discuss again. And it is endemic in organizations. And I don't know the state sector well, I have to say, but I can imagine it's worse in that environment. So again, I think the nature of cooperation is at the heart of your problem. Now, there are actually some very simple tools for solving these problems. Yep. One is the approach I've mentioned, the star and spaghetti, clarifying your cooperation. There's lots of stuff you can do to clarify decision-making rights. You can use RACI to identify who should really be involved in decisions. To be honest, I personally avoid the state sector because a couple of times I've worked with organizations there, I just don't see a will to change this. I see a lot of complaining about it, but I see very little will to do something. And if that's the situation, if the will is lacking, then training just becomes an organized complaining session. So I don't think these problems are hard to solve. I think changing the corporate culture in that environment is enormously difficult. So there are tools, but you need someone with the will to make that change.
And again, going back to my focus at the moment, it's around individual leadership, people stepping up to actually do what it takes to make things better.
It is. And, you know, I worked with a group of CEOs of local governments a couple of years ago, and they spent the whole time telling me how complicated their life was. And I said, well, compared to the large multinationals, no, it's not. You're in one town. You don't have a huge travel problem.
Like a lead balloon.
That's right. They were saying, well, we're incredibly diverse. Well, compared to the world, you know. And so I like to be quite challenging with people and say, look, put it in perspective. You're not as complex as a GE.
Yeah.
You know, or a PepsiCo, you really aren't. And they're doing it. They're getting to grips with this and making it work, you know. And so I think it's a cultural issue, and it's very hard to change the culture of that sector.
Okay, let's move on from that. Robert has a question. Have you found a better way of communicating than emails, which have more and more people included and get longer and longer?
Yes, me and everyone under 25. I think, you know, which by the way, I'm not in that demographic. But,
no, me neither, I'm afraid.
The under 25s aren't using email at all. I mean, it's really dying out in that group.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing more generally is a move towards what we call pull technology, like social media and blogs and those kind of things, and away from push technology. So push technology interrupts you. Yeah. So.
Yep.
You receive something which interrupts you, and the person who decides whether that's worth you looking at is actually the sender. An email is the classic of that. And as a result, because I'm the sender and I don't pay the cost of reading this rubbish, you know, reply to all. Now, pull technology says, let's make the information available for when the recipient wants it or needs it. So, for example, within my own organization, we use a social media tool called Huddle for best practice sharing and IP development. So we don't want to have emails all the time. Every time any of us thinks of something interesting or sees something useful. But when we're looking at a particular tool or a particular model, it's really nice to be able to go in there and see all the different perspectives that people have and the interesting articles they found and the relevant cartoons. So I think that's a big movement, and I'd strongly encourage companies to look at moving from push to pull.
Really interesting. We had a speaker on the summit a couple of years ago, Elizabeth Harran, who's written a book about social media for projects and programs. And, you know, because I've been thinking a lot of the people on the summit are going to be people working on projects and programs, maybe project managers and so on. And just thinking, you know, how do you cope on projects and programs when you haven't got a star group of people all the same? You're actually a group of people trying to get something done together. But there again, you're not that, you know, very tiny group of 4 to 6. Often quite large groups and really using things like social media, as you say, you're in Huddle must be quite a useful way of having everybody's access to the core information without everybody having to sit through long update meetings all the time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned some numbers there, and it is in making the matrix work. I really dig into this: which different technologies do you need to support different ways of working? So there's a chapter in there on social media and virtual teams, for example. But sometimes it's just maths, you know. Teamwork, and these are very rough rules of thumb, and there'll always be exceptions. So if you want teamwork, think 4 to 6. Yeah. If a star group can be 10 to 15, a community can be 20 to 50, a network can be 150. So these, you know, these are numbers that recur throughout human organizations in terms of how we structure things. So if you, even if you want teamwork, if there's 30 of you, you can't have it. There's just too many interconnections to sustain. So, you know, if you're running a project team of 18 people because you need that number of people to deliver the work, that's fine. But either run them as a group or break them into sub-teams. Yeah, because sometimes it's just math. Sometimes you just can't do it, particularly when you're working through technology. You know, if you sit on conference calls with 20 people, it ain't teamwork, right?
No, I have. I have somebody who I won't reveal who they are, but she's part of a big global team. With they have their calls at 11 o'clock at night, and she says she sits down with a large glass of wine, makes sure she's heard at the beginning, and then lies down. And often wakes up after the call has finished, if nobody's mentioned her name.
It's ridiculous. And, you know, the first thing people often say to me, how can I know that people are there on my conference call? I say, well, you can know that they're not, first of all, because the research shows that 25% of people aren't even there.
Wow.
Another 25% are multitasking. Now, multitasking means
only
I'm not there.
Only 25%?
Well, add them together, because 25% aren't there, 25% are multitasking. So, yeah, and my favorite statistic...
50%? Hang on, I'll stop interrupting. Carry on.
No, go ahead. I mean, it could be more, couldn't it? I mean, we'd all be willing to believe it's more, but this was some research I found from an organization that had looked into it. My famous statistic, by the way, is 8% are not fully dressed.
I take it those aren't the ones dialing in from their offices.
It's a horrible thought, isn't it? But, you know, if again, it's back to if 25% have just gone, 25% are not listening, we're back to 50% waste again, you know? And I always challenge leaders who complain about that. So, well, maybe they're right. Maybe the quality and the content of your call is so poor that they're better off, you know, searching the internet for something interesting.
Mm. Wow. So, Kevin, you've already come up with a lot of useful things, and I know you have a lot more resources, blogs, books, website, training courses, and so on for people who are interested in virtual working, and particularly around making it much more effective by making sure that the work is done and that they're not over, you know, trying to make teams when teams aren't appropriate. Can you tell me a little bit more about some of the things that you do have and where people can find these resources?
Okay, well, you know, I'd like you really to think of us as content experts in three areas: matrix management, virtual teams, and global working. And if you go to www.global-integration.com, you're going to find a lot of resources on there, ranging from details of the training programs. And we have programs that are for leaders, for individual collaborators, and for teams in each of those areas. But you're also going to find details of our YouTube channel, podcasts, articles, cartoons, all kinds of resources around those areas. So, for example, if you're interested in the Star and Spaghetti idea we've talked about today, you'll find a podcast specifically about that and another one about applying it to meetings. And so those are great free resources you can use to share with your team and drive a discussion. If you want to find out more, you can contact us through the site. We also have a LinkedIn group, Matrix Management, the group is called. And if you've got really nothing better to do, you can find me on Twitter at Kevin Hall.
Are you encouraging people to multitask?
Well, you know, these are all pull resources. Yeah. So what we found is that it's a good example in marketing. If you try and interrupt people in marketing, if you cold call them or if you send them an email, you have zero chance of success. But if you make yourself easy to find and accessible and helpful, then if on the day that people need you, then they can find you. And that's our objective.
Super. Kevin, we could carry on for hours, but we are coming to the end of our time today. So I'd like to say a really big thank you to you for your brilliant content and your ideas, the Star Group and the Spaghetti Group and the Community Practice and the Bus Check and so on. I'm sure people will be applying them later on today and in the future as well, and going to find out more. So I'm sure that everybody who's listening in today and also anybody replaying later will find all of this really useful. You've given us a lot to think about and some things that we can start working on straight away.
Thank you very much. The challenge always is in application, so I wish everybody good luck.
Definitely. Good luck to everybody. And thank you so much, Kevin. Thank you, too, to everybody who's listened right through to the very end. Now, during the summit, if you have to miss any sessions or you'd like to listen again another time, you can upgrade to gain permanent access to all the sessions in the summit. If you're interested, go to www.virtualworkingsummit.com/upgrade and you'll find out all the details. Until next time, all the best. Bye.